3. Smoke-filled rooms. When Paul Ryan replaced me as Speaker of the House, one of the first things he complained to me about, besides the nut house I'd left him to manage, was that the office he inherited in the U.S. Capitol reeked of cigarette smoke. Legend has it he spent months cleaning out the smell from curtains and carpets and whatever. It did not agree with Mr. Health Nut, who, as you'll recall, had a photo shoot done at the gym. I love Paul, but we are very, very different people. To this day, people like to bring up my smoking and the fact that my new office in Washington contains a balcony that allows me to excuse myself from meetings to take a few puffs. Someone even wanted to title this book, The Smoke-Filled Room, until my daughter very rightly explained that I didn't want to encourage young kids to get hooked on the stuff. That's the last thing I want to do, because I was just a kid myself when I got hooked on the stuff. I remember vividly the epiphany I had. I was 19 years old and didn't like what I was looking at in the mirror. I weighed 273 pounds. I remember the number with much precision, and had pants with a size 38 waist. The next size up was 40. That was a mental block for me. There was no way in the world I was ever going to let myself buy pants that size, so I knew I had to do something different. I figured I'd eat 3 meals a day, and every time I got hungry between meals, I'd smoke a cigarette. That was in 1968, and it was way before everyone under the sun was screaming about the dangers of smoking. Pregnant ladies were puffing cigarettes in those days. So was James Bond. He could smoke on airplanes and in restaurants and pretty much wherever you pleased. Large ashtrays were everywhere. So give me a break. A little, please. Also, my idea worked. I lost 85 pounds, dropped a couple of waist sizes, and picked up a new bad habit in exchange for eating a bunch of crap all day. At first, I smoked Lucky Strikes with no filter. But whatever brand I started smoking, it kept taking off the market. Now I just hope Camel stays in business. Fingers crossed. I'm not blind to the health risk, and I'm sure as hell don't encourage kids to smoke. But I've told my doctors that I've made it this far in life by smoking and the damage that has been done. They don't stop trying to tell me what I should do, and I don't stop ignoring them. And it works out fine. I did try to quit once in 1985. My wife Deb and I both took a 6-week class for that very purpose. It worked on my wife, and it worked on me for a while, too. Until one day when I found a moment of weakness and smoked one cigarette. That was it. I started scrounging around in gutters for butts to light up. I did have at least one more moment of reflection on this when I joined the board of Reynolds American. It was a funny thing. I noticed that not one single person on the board of one of the world's largest tobacco companies was a smoker. Neither were the senior executives I knew. I never saw any of them touch the stuff. One day during a board meeting, I walked outside for a smoking break, and the head of R&D at the company came up to me. This was the guy who knew more about cigarettes and what goes into them than anyone else in the company, and probably as much as anyone in America. He didn't smoke either. "Hey, Boehner," he said, "you really ought to quit that." In more recent years, I found myself in a very different sector of the smoking community when I joined the board of Acreage Holdings, a cannabis company. But now some people don't believe me when I tell them I've never smoked a joint, but I haven't. I'm not going to rule it out, though. So I guess it's fair to say for most of my life I've been in smoke-filled rooms, which in the old days is what they used to call the back rooms of political intrigue in Washington. But before I ended up in the dark, smoky back rooms, my intrigues, such as they were, started out somewhere very different, a sunny poolside 4th of July party in an all-American suburb. I wasn't really a political person by nature. I didn't pay much attention to politics at all when I was growing up. But when I did, I usually took my cues from my parents, who were solid Democrats. We were a Democrat household, so I went along with that and assumed I was a Democrat too. Besides, I had so much other stuff to worry about, the politics didn't even make the top 10. As I was getting ready to graduate high school, I was almost completely taken over by stress about what I was going to do next. I wanted to go to college, but I had no money. I did okay at school, but wasn't that great. I liked playing sports, but wasn't that great at those either, which meant no scholarships for me. So I knew whatever I did, I was going to have to pay my way. Between school and sports, I was working every part-time job known to man. When I first graduated, I knew I couldn't try for college right away, but I still had to make money, so I kept working whatever job I could find. I took my first shot at college in the fall of 1968 at the University of Cincinnati. That didn't go so well. Then I took a job in construction and after a while decided to join the Navy to put that experience to use as a Seabee. But my screwed-up back put an end to that just after a couple of months with a medical discharge. More on that later. By September 1969, I was out of the Navy, back in the odd jobs. I worked construction again and roofing. Eventually got myself into Xavier University, going part-time because I needed to keep working all those other random jobs to pay my way. I picked up extra money refereeing high school sports, too. Really wasn't that different from high school. I was either at school or at work. That was it. It wasn't easy, but I kept plugging along that way for several years, with no real goal of mine other than graduating college, eventually. But things started looking up in the summer of 1972. People I knew around town who worked at Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals had recruited me for their company's softball team. I was a decent softball player in those days. To play on the team, you actually had to work for the company, so they gave me a job as an overnight janitor, working from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. For anyone keeping score at home, between night work, day work, college classes, my time for sleep was, well, not much. One morning that summer, it was about 6:45 a.m., and I was cleaning off one of my last desks when this cute girl walked into the office. She was coming into work early that day. If she'd come in a few minutes later, I'd have been gone and have missed her completely, and I would never have met my wife. Deb and I got married the next year. We had about $400 cash between us. She had three rocking chairs, a TV set, and a few other furniture odds and ends. That was it. We may not have had a ton going for us, but we loved each other. Suddenly, everything came into focus. Life had a lot more direction and meaning. I finally got my degree from Xavier in 1977 and went to work full-time at Newsite Sales, a small company that provided plastics and packaging to a whole lot of manufacturers all over Southwest Ohio. I liked the sales work, getting to know people, finding out what they needed, putting the deals together. I finally found a job I could make into a career, and that's just what I did. I stayed with Newsite, helped it expand, took over as president after my boss died, and ran it until I went to Congress in 1991. Deb and I moved into a new house on July 3, 1977, and the next day my buddy Al Buzmeyer, who lived nearby, invited us to the neighborhood 4th of July celebration at the local pool. It was a great way to meet neighbors, but I was in for far more than I bargained. Somewhere in the conversation that afternoon, it came up that a seat representing my section of the board of the Lakota Hills Homeowners Association was vacant. Someone said, "How about the new guy?" I'd been in the neighborhood for all of a day, and all of a sudden, I was on the HOA board. Next thing I knew, I was Speaker of the House. A few things had to happen in the meantime, though. As the 1970s turned into the 1980s, I got a bit more serious about politics. Even though I was raised in a family of Democrats, I bucked the trend a few times. I voted for Nixon in 1972 and Ford in 1976. And now, because I was making a bit more money, the government was taking a bigger chunk of it. In those days, they took a lot. In 1978, I paid more in taxes than I made gross in 1976. In those days, once you made about $74,500, 70 cents of every dollar you made went to the federal government. I thought that was outrageous. Around the same time, there was somebody else emerging on the national scene who felt the same way. Former California Governor Ronald Reagan. He was talking about economics in a way that really made small business folks like me sit up and pay attention. Things didn't have to be this way, he said, and sketched out a vision of new tax rates, supply-side economics, combating inflation, and unleashing the power of the free market. So I finally looked around and said to myself, I'm not a Democrat anymore. I'm a Republican, and I'm a Reagan Republican too. That turned out to be a little controversial in those days, as it is today according to some. Everyone I knew that was involved in Republican politics was campaigning for George Bush in the 1980 Republican primary. Bush was supposed to be the anointed one that year, and he was by the media. Reagan was portrayed as too old, too Hollywood, too much of a right-wing extremist. Well, none of that bothered me one bit. I stuck with my guy, as far as I was concerned. The sun rose and set with Ronald Reagan. While he was running for president, my own smaller-time political career was ramping up as well. This was not something I had set out for, but things just seemed to keep moving. In the spring of 1980, I was asked to be president of the Homeowners Association. I was the youngest guy on the board, but I guess nobody else wanted to deal with the work. As president, I was involved with coordinating with other local groups, like the local school board, as our community grew and expanded. That led to meeting more and more people, and the next thing I knew, I was running for an open township trustee seat. I was only 31 years old, and the first day I went out to knock on doors, it hit me. Who am I to ask these people to vote for me? Who did I think I was? But I went ahead and did it anyway. Between me and a few friends, we knocked on every single door in Westchester, Ohio. We were welcome in some places more than others. One woman met me at the door with a snarling Doberman who looked like he was ready to rip my guts out on command. But because I stood my ground and delivered my pitch on the doorstep with one eye on those sharp, nasty fangs, she promised to vote for me. I guess this was some kind of sick test she pulled on people. On the other hand, I still have friends to this day that I first met when they opened their door to hear my pitch in 1981. That's meant more to me than winning the election itself, although that was pretty nice too. I like to think that Ronald Reagan helped inspire me to run. In a way, even though party politics didn't do much good at the local level, which is much harder than governing at the federal level, by the way, I grew into a Reagan Republican, and I became more and more involved in the community. That's the philosophy I tried to stick with all the way, working toward a smaller, fairer, and more responsible government. That's what Reagan stood for. I don't think Ronald Reagan would recognize the Republican Party today, and he sure as hell couldn't get elected in it. As a matter of fact, Reagan would be the most left-wing candidate in the GOP these days by a mile, which is why I laugh whenever politicians celebrate their fetish for Reagan. They don't have the first damn clue about who he was. Reagan didn't operate on the principle of all or nothing. He knew that getting 80% of what you wanted counted as a victory. He believed in finding common ground, building coalitions, and working across the aisle with Democrat House Speaker Tip O'Neill to get things done instead of throwing bombs to score points with partisan media. We could learn a lot from that approach today, but unfortunately, most of us probably won't. In fact, more often than not, that approach got me into a hell of a lot of trouble once the crazies came to town. Anybody who says there are rules to the political game is probably not very good at playing it. Rules can hem you in. I followed the law and my own code of ethics, especially remembering to do the right things for the right reasons. But beyond that, I tried to avoid the hard and fast rules when it comes to applying political pressure or working different angles. Every situation was different. Whether it was the constitutional amendment fight, the investigation of an internal institution like the House Bank, or tense negotiations with President Obama. They all demanded their own approaches, and all offered their own lessons. Mostly I learned from experience, letting the lessons of different successes and failures guide me along the way. Sometimes, for instance, I ran up against the so-called rules that just seemed made to be broken. That's what happened during my first campaign for Congress in 1990. The Ohio 8th Congressional District is a solid Republican district, so the real race was in the Republican primary. My top opponent was Tom Kindness, who had represented the district in Congress a few years back. His name was tailor-made for politics. Well, mine wasn't. It was a rule, I was told, that nobody's going to vote for you if they can't pronounce your name. All through life, I had heard my name pronounced any different way you can think of. In high school, of course, it was Boner. I also heard Beaner, Bonner, and plenty of other variations. So we decided to lean into that in my first campaign and cut a radio ad featuring an older couple named George and Helen. George, Helen in the ad, who's this John Beaner guy? No, Helen, that's John Boehner, George responded, pronouncing it correctly. He's a small businessman from Westchester. And it went on from there. The idea was to set people straight, but gently. We even put pronunciation guides in our printed material, cluing people in that it was pronounced like B-A-Y-N-E-R. It took some people a little while, but they figured it out, And I figured out that the old rule that they won't vote for you if they can't say your name isn't always true. Who would have expected Boner to be kindness? I wasn't sure what to expect when I got to Washington, but I do remember my first impression. This is just like the Ohio legislature, I thought, but bigger. I'd served in the Ohio House from 1985 through 1990 and met all sorts of people. I met some of the smartest guys I'd ever known, and some of the dumbest. I met some of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet, and some of the nastiest. When I got to Washington, I met many of the same sorts of characters. Any legislative assembly, anywhere you go in the world, is like that. All kinds of people thrown together to argue and hopefully get stuff done, all bringing their talents and their strange baggage to the table. The strangest story I ever heard about a politician, which is saying something, concerned a public servant who once gave his daughter a ticket to a football game. It was one of the family's season tickets, and this happened all the time. But when the woman arrived at the game, she found an unfamiliar woman sitting in the seat next to hers, also part of the family tickets. When she asked her neighbor where she got her ticket, she was told, "I got it from my dad." In response, the first woman said, "I got mine from my dad." And that was how these women discovered they were half-sisters, that this gentleman had two separate families. I know I wouldn't have believed it either, but my source is unimpeachable. Like I said, politics takes all kinds of people, but some, apparently, are more equal than others. One person I didn't get to meet when I arrived in Washington was the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley. I couldn't even get near him. When I first showed up in the Ohio legislature, Democrats had been in control for more than 20 years. I was the newest member of the minority party, which meant I was less than nothing on the pecking order. The Speaker of the Ohio House, Vern Reif, was a Democrat from Scioto County in the southern part of the state, not far from Cincinnati. He'd held the gavel with an iron fist since 1975 and would end up serving 20 years as Speaker. I wasn't important to him at all, but he made time to meet with me when I first arrived, and I was able to get to know him. U.S. House Speaker Tom Foley, on the other hand, wanted nothing to do with me. Following what I had learned in the Ohio House, I called Speaker Foley's office not long after I got to Washington to set up a meeting to introduce myself. The Speaker didn't have time for that, I was told. So I called again and got the same answer. I must have called a dozen times in early 1991 when I first took my seat, and I got rejected every time. That taught me something, not just about Foley, but about what the pomp and circumstance of leadership can do to people. And I made sure to file that away. Two things I made sure to keep in mind from the very beginning were what I believed are the two responsibilities I had as an elected representative. First, I listened to my constituents. But second, and just as important, I had to consider my own background and experience. By combining these two together, I would come to a decision about the right thing to do. Done for the right reasons, of course. The way I saw it, as long as I stuck to those principles and stayed right with the law and with God, pretty much everything else was fair game. And things got pretty real pretty fast. My first major vote, beyond standard procedural stuff, was on the authorization for use of military force in Operation Desert Storm in 1991. I was a freshman in Congress. I had a lot to learn about the place, and here I was sending American troops into battle to potentially die for their country. It was a real baptism of fire. It made clear to me, damn quick, that we weren't just talking to hear ourselves talk on the House floor or arguing about abstract things. This was serious. As if the vote hadn't brought that home to me, something happened later that day that did for sure. I flew back to Ohio after the vote, and that evening Deb and I went to a restaurant for a quiet dinner, just the two of us, to catch up on things since I'd been gone. During the meal, a woman came up to me and introduced herself. She told me she had a relative in the military who was ready to be deployed to the Gulf. She had just one question. "Congressman," she said, "I'd like to know how you voted today." I looked at Deb. I looked back at the woman. There was nothing I could do except be straight with her. "I voted to authorize the war," I told her. I braced myself, not sure what she would say or do. Anything could happen. "God bless you," she said. "If you're comfortable with your decision, I can respect it." I still remember that conversation. It brought the reality of all the political crap people were slinging in Washington home to me. There were real people's lives at stake here. A few days later, when the Gulf War actually began, I was interviewed about it in my living room by a reporter for a local Cincinnati TV station. His name was Bill Hemmer, and he went on to become a veteran TV newsman, first at CNN and then at Fox, his home for many years. But whenever I see him, I think of the earnest young cub reporter in my living room. Voting to send American troops to war kept my colleagues whining over the house bank and restaurant in perspective. I took some early lumps for going after those perks of the job. I guess that was a fair amount of shit for a new member to stir up, but it didn't bother me much. For one, I knew I was doing the right thing, plus I was making my own plans to look further into the future. As a new member, I had joined a group called the Conservative Opportunity Society. Some people looked at us as the renegade Republicans, but we preferred to think of ourselves as activists. Newt Gingrich was a member, as were Tom DeLay, Dick Armey, John Kyle, Jim Bunning. We met every Wednesday morning and tried to find ways to make Republicans more effective despite being in the House minority. In the years that followed, I would have a hell of a time contending with groups formed by so-called conservatives that ostensibly were about making us carry out policies more effectively. But there were some key differences. None of us were crazy. Well, most of us weren't anyway. And we also knew our limits. We weren't for blowing up the entire government just because we could. And we even worked with and liked many members of the opposition party, even though they were lording over us in a very annoying way. At this point, Democrats had held an iron grip on the House for decades. Republicans had, over the years, gotten used to just accepting the crumbs that the Democrat leadership left for us from their cake. They seemed to have accepted, as fact, the idea that we were always going to be in a minority. I would argue that in those days, there had never been a serious attempt to regain a Republican majority in the House. That complacent attitude went straight to the top. Bob Michael, the Republican leader at the time, was very much of the Republican old school. At that time, that meant being a dutiful loser and taking whatever the Democrats dished out. I got along great with Bob and had a lot of respect for him. But I knew if we were going to be effective as a congressional party, we would need someone new at the helm. Bob was like a school principal, nice, likable, able to deal with administrative issues. We needed someone with a sharper edge, like the assistant principal who was in charge of detention and seemed to enjoy it. And they needed to be meaner, like maybe a school lunch lady. I have a thing about lunch ladies, as you'll see later. Enter Newt Gingrich. You may have heard of him. Where do I begin on Newt? He was smart. He's fast on his feet, a sharp-elbowed campaigner. He was a historian by training and first been elected to Congress in 1978, so he'd been around a while and seen a lot. He also had that air of destiny about him, like he felt he was meant for great things. Someone stepped in his path toward greatness. Well, that was their problem. In late 1993, I started meeting every once in a while with Newt and a small group of members to discuss how we might make him the next leader. There aren't many secrets in Washington, and naturally, Bob Michael was aware of Gingrich's ambitions. Newt also wasn't exactly known for playing it cool. As a result, there was tension between the two camps, for sure. But having a good relationship with both men, I tried to keep things from getting too heated. As it turned out, though, there was no need for a leadership struggle. In early 1994, Bob Michael announced he was going to retire at the age of 71. Which still made him something of a spring chicken among the old birds of the House. He wasn't a dummy. He knew he could either leave through the door or get tossed out of a window. We quickly rallied around Newt as his successor, but we knew that in order to make that happen, we had to do a better job of engaging all Republican members in a way that had never been done before. People like being brought in. They like to feel like they have skin in the game. For all of Newt's other skills, this was one of his biggest tests. The annual Republican members' retreat was coming up when all of us would pack into buses like kids going off to summer camp and head off to some hotel in the D.C. area for a weekend of presentations. Mostly, we were talked at by leadership, pollsters, and so on. I decided, along with a couple of other Conservative Opportunity Society guys, that instead of just being talked at, we should talk to the members. It should be a conversation among the whole family, not just a bunch of kids sitting there while the adults and leadership lectured them. Nobody likes being lectured. Well, it turned out to be maybe the best retreat we'd ever had. Suddenly, members were actually talking to one another, trying to understand one another, working to get to a position where we knew who we were and what we were there to do. And we decided that we, after all these years, were finally going to bring back a Republican majority to the House. At that retreat, pushed on by this newfound energy, we began to hatch the plan. Bill Clinton's first term had not been going well. I couldn't figure out how he blundered so badly since his skillful campaign of 1992, where he managed to survive accusations of adultery, draft dodging, being a communist, drug running, and even mass murder. Some of those allegations were more credible than others, but I'll let you decide which is which. Baba had run for president as the new kind of Democrat, a Southern moderate. And yet the very first things he did were to pursue liberal social policies that many in the country just weren't ready for. A total takeover of our healthcare system, for one, allowing gays to serve openly in the military, for another, earned him a rebuke from national hero Colin Powell. It was around this time that I first met a Southern Democrat senator named Hal Heflin. Heflin was an old-school deal-making Pole. He was a former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court and a beloved figure in the state. There's no way he could be a Democrat if he ran for office today. He thought the Clinton crowd was a bunch of radical hippies who were taking over his party. Gays in the military as an issue, well, it just wasn't his thing. So I'll never forget our first meeting. I was at a D.C. restaurant, sitting with a group of other legislators having a good time. Suddenly, I felt a tap on my shoulder. I turned around to see a very round, older man with slick back hair. It was Senator Heflin. Seeing me hold a camel in my hand, he said with a thick Alabama drawl, "I'm glad to see you smoking that cigarette." He told me he had just gone to the White House that day, his first visit since the Clintons were elected. It was not a kumbaya moment. "I lit up my cigarette like I always did," the senator told me, his eyes flickering with annoyance. "And these kids come running over saying, 'Oh, Senator, Senator, you can't smoke here.' I looked back at them and I said, 'I can't smoke here, but it would be okay if I put a penis in my mouth.'" Anyway, that was the cultural blowback Clinton was dealing with. His approval ratings were low and getting lower. The American people were souring on the Clinton charm, although I'm not sure how much charm there really was. I always thought he reminded me of Eddie Haskell, the kiss-up kid from the old TV show Leave It to Beaver. But we couldn't just run against the president. We had to offer an alternative, something to get voters in congressional districts all over the country to take a serious look at Republican candidates. It was Newt who came up with the idea of the contract with America. Sometimes Newt would go into eccentric professor mode and come up with pie-in-the-sky ideas without much follow-through. And at first we thought, that might be what was happening here. But the more we looked at it, the more the idea gained momentum. And before we knew it, it had focused on 10 key issues and even written legislation we promised to enact to advance the agenda. We raised the money to unveil this to the American people with a one-page ad in Reader's Digest, which at the time was one of the most widely read monthly publications in the country. In the run-up to the election, we held an event where everybody signed the contract publicly. I don't know if the contract with America got us the majority. Newt, of course, believed that it did. Personally, I think Bill Clinton got us the majority. But the contract certainly helped, and it gave all of us Republicans something to organize ourselves around. And in that regard, it soon became clear that we needed all the help we could get. We were about to get a crash course in the very distinct differences between politics and governing. That's a lesson a lot of people in Congress and the White House these days have never learned. Election night 1994 was a thrilling moment. All our hard work had paid off, and Republicans had taken back the House after all those years. But after we got the celebratory shit out of the way, we realized we had no clue how to run the place. None. Nobody in the entire Republican Congress had ever served in the majority in the House. Not one. There was no institutional memory, and we had to figure it all out as we went along. We were given lists of offices to assign in the Capitol and had no idea who was currently in them. We didn't even know where some of them were. As a majority party, we were now responsible for the Capitol and coordinating all the permanent non-political staff who made the building run, the engineers, the electricians, the carpenters, and so on. We had to schedule a special tour with the architect of the Capitol so he could show some of us around and point out areas of the old building we didn't even know existed. Eventually, despite the fits and starts, we did take over, and 1995 began with Newt becoming the 50th Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. He was an instant superstar. On the cover of Time magazine, his news conferences carried live, recognized everywhere. The huge boost of oxygen would take a toll on even the most modest of men. And then there was Newt Gingrich. As I say, Newt was one of the brightest people I've ever met, and I liked him, and still do. I credit him with a lot. But like any of us, he had his flaws. As I said, sometimes the eccentric professor side of him came out. He had 100 ideas an hour, and maybe 90 of them made sense. Those last 10, though, well, they could be trouble. Oh, how he loved to strategize. Unfortunately, we never had time to implement last week's strategic plan before he came up with a new one. Newt used to advertise his management philosophy on a sign mounted in his office, which read, "Listen, learn, help, and lead." Occasionally, he'd even do some of these things. At one point, some of us on his leadership team turned the sign upside down so the instructions were in reverse order, which reflected the reality. I guess he didn't think it was too funny because when we came in for the next meeting, the sign had been moved up higher on the wall, out of reach. Whichever way the sign was facing, Newt had to manage more than 200 members, all jockeying for position in the new majority. He didn't always have time or patience for all of that. If two members came up to Newt with conflicting requests, his instincts would be to say yes to both of them, just so he could get them out of his hair and move on to his next big idea he was interested in. And while Newt was off on his vision quest, it was up to the rest of us and the leadership team to clean up the mess. This is where I came in. When Newt became Speaker, I became the chairman of the House Republican Conference, the fourth ranking position on the House leadership ladder. The body of all Republicans in the House taken together is known as the Republican Conference. The Democrats call themselves a caucus because, of course, we can't do it the same way. The job of the conference chair is to keep 200 or so rank-and-file Republican members on the same page as the top three in the leadership, the majority whip, the majority leader, and the speaker, to make sure everyone sticks to the same unified message. It might seem strange for a guy to spend his first couple of years throwing bombs from the floor, often toward his own side of the aisle, only to end up as part of the leadership. Gingrich knew what he was doing by bringing one of the rabble-rousers of the Gang of Seven into the leadership team. Besides, I had my eye on leadership from the beginning. At the very end of 1990, after I'd been elected but before I got sworn in, I sat down with Barry Jackson and a few other friends, soon to be staffers, and we had a simple conversation. They asked me, "Well, what kind of member do you want to be?" We talked through different types. For some members, it was all about the district, so they stayed focused on local issues. Some got really into their committee work and became experts on the particular policy area they worked on. But then there was the leadership track, helping craft the agenda, keeping the team together to get things done. Well, I didn't have to think about it for very long. I was going to be a leadership guy, and that was that. From there, it was pretty easy to figure out the end goal. If I didn't want to end up at the top of the leadership ladder as speaker, what was the point of climbing on in the first place? So while I spent a fair amount of time causing trouble with the Gang of Seven, I also made a point to do everything I could for my fellow members to help them raise money. And yeah, money talks. People liked that I was willing to show up for a golf outing or a dinner or a reception and give a little speech about how great a guy the candidate was. It was not like they had to twist my arm either. I was having a pretty good time. When we took back the majority in 1994, I knew it was time to make a move. No, I hadn't been there very long, and yes, I'd ruffled some feathers, but I worked my ass off to help us take back the House, and I was damn sure going to help us run the show. Naturally, I wasn't the only one with that idea. Before we even left to campaign for the final leg of the 1994 election, There have been discussions amongst the Republican members over how to proceed if we won the majority. Members were already angling for committee and leadership spots. The top contender for conference chair looked to be Representative Bob Livingston. Livingston was a Southern gentleman from Louisiana who'd been in Congress since 1977. Bob was, in many ways, the natural choice, and I'm sure he had made a fine chairman, but I had other ideas. After the election, with the majority official, I still hadn't declared myself in the leadership race. But I had been helping our transition team talk through committee assignments, which gave me an idea. And I picked up the phone and called Bob Livingston. "Bob," I asked, "wouldn't you rather be chairman of the Appropriations Committee?" The Appropriations Committee held the purse strings for the entire government. Since all federal funding bills had to originate in the House, his chairman was one of the most powerful committee posts on the Hill. Even the subcommittee chairs, not usually the most glamorous titles, were unofficially called cardinals. Well, Bob didn't waste any time in responding, "Yeah." "I'll tell you what," I offered. "You get out of this conference race, and I'll do everything I can to help you." Sure enough, Bob called Gingrich to let him know he was no longer interested in the conference spot. Of course, I had tipped off Gingrich, and he went along with my plan. When the new Congress was sworn in January, Bob Livingston took up the gavel as Appropriations Committee chairman. One down. I was officially in the race by this time, and the only other formidable contender was Duncan Hunter, Sr. of California. My member friends, my staff, and I started working the phones hard, talking members' ears off and twisting their arms to try to get their support. We knew Hunter and his buddies were doing the same thing, too. Until one day they weren't. In the middle of the leadership race, Hunter had somehow just disappeared for a couple of days. He dropped off the map. Finally, we figured out what had happened. He had a late fall hunting trip scheduled for after the election, but before Christmas. He'd been looking forward to it and wasn't going to let a leadership election spoil it for him. So he disappeared off into the woods over a long weekend, mostly cut off from the world. This was before our cell phones were genetically attached. That gave me all the time I needed. By the time Hunter resurfaced the following Monday, I had already lined up enough votes to become the new conference chair. When the new majority took over in January 1995, the leadership team was Speaker Gingrich, Majority Leader Dick Armey, Majority Whip Tom DeLay, both Texans, and me. I knew that personalities were key to the leadership staff of any organization. They can take on an outsized influence when politicians are involved. Armey and I got along great. My staff got along great with his staff, which is key to making any leadership operation run smoothly. The staff have to be able to all work with one another. DeLay and his people, on the other hand, always seemed to be marching to their own beat. DeLay had a strong personality and seemed to run his office like a dictatorship. His staff were either loyal or scared or both, and they shut out everybody else. The staff problems got so bad that it seemed like his staff were carrying out vendettas against other leadership staffers. There were thorns in everyone's side. And my personal relationship with DeLay wasn't much better either. I remember from some of the earliest meetings I attended as a new member, he looked at me funny. Maybe he saw a threat. It's hard to say. As it turned out, it wasn't just me. Our first member retreat in the majority, Armey and I found ourselves with adjoining rooms. I ran into him in the hallway and asked if I could talk to him in private. He came into my room, shut the door, shoved the rug up against the crack at the bottom of the door. He was not playing around. "What's up?" he asked. I said, "Help me understand Tom DeLay. Dick's been around longer than I had, and I figured he might have some insight." "You think I can help you understand him?" Dick came back. "He doesn't like me at all." "Well, he doesn't like me either," I responded, and neither of us left that day with any better understanding of how DeLay's mind worked or didn't, as the case might be. He never got any easier to understand or work with during the rest of the time we served in leadership together. It was from DeLay's unique brand of political calculation that the idea came to campaign on a promise to impeach Bill Clinton in a run-up to the 1998 midterms. For those who don't remember what the Clinton case involved, here's a brief primer. Everybody with eyes and or ears knew about Bill Clinton's reputation with women. When he got himself involved with a 22-year-old intern, Monica Lewinsky, and then appeared to lie about it and encourage others to lie, many people around town assumed he was done. I thought he'd die from embarrassment or maybe at the hands of his wife. Whether what he did as president was a high crime or misdemeanor, requiring some impeachment, was another story. I've lived through three presidential impeachment inquiries: Nixon's, Clinton's, and Trump's. But there was only one, Bill Clinton's, where I was a participant as a member of the House leadership. I know what we all said at the time: Bill Clinton was impeached for lying under oath. In my view, Republicans impeached him for one reason and one reason only: because it was strenuously recommended to us by one Tom DeLay. Tom believed that impeaching Clinton would win us all these House seats, would be a big win politically, and he convinced enough of the membership and the GOP base that this was true. I was on board at the time. I won't hide from that. I won't pretend otherwise. But I regret it now, and I regret that I didn't fight against it. Impeachment of the president is meant to be a tool of last resort. Nancy Pelosi had it right, or at least she did at first, when she contemplated impeaching Donald Trump. It has to be bipartisan. Not everyone in both parties has to be on board, but at least a good number do. A partisan impeachment simply does not have credibility to most Americans. That's exactly what we pursued against Clinton. Clinton probably did commit perjury. That's not a good thing. But lying about an affair to save yourself from embarrassment isn't the same as lying about an issue of national security. DeLay, however, was absolutely convinced that this was the right thing to do, and for the next 6 weeks leading up to the election, all we talked about was impeachment. Instead of gaining 5 seats like we expected, we lost 5 seats. Even though DeLay had been the one beating the impeachment horse hardest, the responsibility lay at the top. Even putting aside impeachment, Newt had become a real problem for the Republican majority. His management issues hadn't improved. Meanwhile, I was dealing with management issues of my own. By this time, my two daughters, Lindsay and Tricia, had grown from two of the cutest little girls you ever hoped to see into, well, teenagers. They were still cute. I still loved them to death. But two teenage girls, close in age, stuck at home with their outnumbered mother while I was spending half my time in Washington, it was a recipe for disaster. Deb was holding the fort, but I was always ready to help. There was no way those girls were going to get away with more just because their dad was away for work. There were plenty of times when I'd be sitting at my desk, on the phone, on one line with some member, trying to defuse a crisis in the House Republican ranks, while on another line, I'd have Deb telling me what trouble the girls were giving her, and then Lindsay and Tricia themselves on a third line giving me their side of the story, and everybody trying to talk at once. It was around that time I gave the girls nicknames: Bad and Worse. And Lindsay was usually worse. Sorry, honey. So you can forgive me for getting tired of Newt's absent-minded professor shtick after a while. And it wasn't wearing thin just for me. It sometimes got in the way of his getting along with his members. Because he was so busy thinking, he'd end up making snap decisions and then moving on. Or he'd get so wrapped up in thought while walking the halls of the Capitol, or the tunnels underneath, or on the sidewalk above, that he wouldn't pay attention to his colleagues walking past. He wouldn't even acknowledge them, let alone stop and say hi. Sometimes it felt like he was the star of some big college faculty, and those of us in the rank and file were jockeying for time during his office hours. Even when I was a pretty new arrival myself, I wasn't shy about giving him advice. "Newt," I'd remind him, respectfully of course, "when you pass one of your members in the hall, stop and say hello. These are the people who can vote for you or vote against you." And he'd always promise to be better about it. Sometimes he was, but usually he'd go back to doing the things his own way. He had let his press attention get to his head, and the press loved to feed on their own creations. There was a sense that he was getting rolled by the Clinton White House, like, every day. He was often disheveled. Back in the 90s, he wore some of the worst neckties I've ever seen. I remember telling him early on, "Newt, you've got to buy some new ties. Those are just awful." One time in early 1996, Newt hustled back from a meeting at the White House, and the first thing out of his mouth to all of us waiting anxiously for his report was, "Clinton really liked my tie." We all rolled our eyes. "And you probably believed him," I said. This was the same old Eddie Haskell-like Clinton charm. He could steal your watch right in front of you, and you'd be grateful when he told you the time. Clinton had been on the ropes when Republicans took power, but he was a survivor. He masterfully used Newt's weaknesses against him. It was my job to break the news to Gingrich that it was time for him to step down as Speaker. The day after the election, he called me. "What do you think?" he said. "Newt, you're not going to want to hear this," I told him, "but I think you've led the team as far as you can lead them." It was clear that was not the answer he was expecting. "As your friend," I told him, "I just don't think you'll have the votes come January to be elected Speaker." He thanked me, got off the line. The next day he called me again. "Well, what do you think?" he asked. "The same thing I thought yesterday. What did I tell you about his listening skills?" That time he got the message, and by the next day he had announced his intention to resign. But Newt wasn't the only casualty of the 1998 midterm losses. In late 1998, a member from Oklahoma, J.C. Watts, announced he was going to run to replace me as conference chair. Watts was a charismatic former college football star who'd been elected in the class that helped us take back the House in 1994. I respected the challenge, but I expected to hold on. This was until I realized that Watts had some real muscle in his corner. Two senior members, Bud Schuster of Pennsylvania and Jerry Lewis of California, were supporting Watts' candidacy. Schuster and Lewis, it just so happened, were also two of the members who tried to dissuade me and the rest of the Gang of Seven from looking too deeply into the House bank scandal in 1991. Watts beat me fair and square. Interestingly, one of the members to vote for Watts in that leadership election was a new representative from Wisconsin who had just been elected but not yet taken his seat, a 28-year-old named Paul Ryan. He comes up later in the story. By the time I made my second run at leadership, becoming House Majority Leader in 2006 and then Minority Leader in 2007 after the Democrats took over, I had learned a fair amount both from my years serving under Newt and in the intervening time since. I knew, for instance, that it was better to have talented members with a rabble-rousing streak working with you rather than against you. Put another way, it was better to have them inside the tent pissing out than outside pissing in. And I knew I had a great place to install these sorts of people. Those who had true leadership potential was in the position of conference chair. I knew from personal experience that serving as conference chair was a great way to understand how things really worked behind the curtain of leadership. There was a tendency, especially among the more firebrand rank-and-file members, to think the leadership folks were always up to something, plotting behind closed doors. Bringing the skeptics in showed them there really wasn't anything nefarious going on, that we were just trying to keep the team together. In the latter 2000s, much of the criticism from the Republican right flank came from the Republican Study Committee, the RSC. There was no Freedom Caucus then. It later grew out of a more extreme right wing of the RSC. But these guys were the self-styled true conservative members and were convinced that leadership was always trying to drag the party too far to the middle. The post of RSC chairman, while not an official leadership position, usually went to people who were trusted to speak for this faction. Some of the guys elevated to that role showed real political promise. I tried to spot that and help them along. One such talent was Jeb Henschling from Texas, who went on to become conference chair and then a very effective chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. Another was a very serious, passionate Indiana congressman named Mike Pence. When he first came to Congress, Pence was a fire eater, or at least well on his way to becoming one. He came from the world of talk radio, where he hadn't been afraid to court controversy. As soon as he came to the House, he'd identified strongly with the RSC, serving as its chairman from 2005 to 2007. We'd clashed over policy before, like when Pence had come out against No Child Left Behind in 2001, we also clashed over leadership. Pence had run against me for minority leader in 2005. But still, I preferred to have him pissing inside the tent than outside it. Pence was a good member, but he needed an outlet for his energy. I tried to guide him toward being more measured in his approach to governing, to show him that not every single action he may not have fully approved of needed his own scathing press release, or that sometimes you have to pick your battles. Over time, and certainly by the time he became conference chair in 2009, he had developed into a calm, collected, unflappable professional, a skill set he used to great effect as vice president of the United States. Maybe the most important aspect of House leadership is the daily management meeting that takes place every morning around 9 or 9:30. Before that, the members in leadership all huddle with their senior staff. But when the members gather for their meeting, the real business gets done. The speaker, the leader, the whip, the conference chair, are the main attendees, with other members coming in and out. Members can bring a staffer or two, and sometimes the meeting room, usually somewhere in the speaker's suite, gets crowded. I tried to run those meetings like a conversation. With Newt, it was all over the place. When I was majority leader under Speaker Dennis Hastert for about a year, it was more of a lecture. Hastert had already decided what we're going to do and was issuing orders. Well, that just wasn't my style. Hastert wasn't a particularly charismatic speaker, but he did have the presence of a coach. He'd been a high school wrestling coach for years, and years later, it was allegations of abuse of students stemming from that time that eventually sent him to prison. I was about to walk into a fundraiser at a lovely home in Pennsylvania when the news broke, and I was stunned. Then I ran into someone I'd known from the Hill who had worked for Hastert, and obviously he had just heard it too. He was as ashen-faced as I've ever seen a living person look. Looking back on it, the time I spent in the leadership under Hastert was also the scene of another strange episode. Sometime in the spring of 2006, not long after I made majority leader, someone came to me and asked me about Representative Mark Foley of Florida and kids in the House PAGE program, suggesting there was a problem. Well, that was news to me, so I did what I thought was the right thing and went straight to Hastert and told him what had been shared with me, and left it with him. He seemed interested at the time, but obviously didn't do anything about it, because the story broke out of nowhere in late September that Foley had behaved inappropriately with young male pages. In fact, I was in a meeting with Hastert when he excused himself to take a call, came back, and told me it was about to break. Well, I was livid. He had had a chance to address it internally and clearly had not done so. Now the Democrats had a scandal to hang around our necks before the 2006 midterms, which ended up bringing the Democrats back into power. But before that, we had to go through a whole ethics investigation. It was a mess. That was just one incident. But in general, I knew that when I became Speaker, I didn't want to run the House like the last Republican to hold that post. I wanted the back and forth. I wanted honest feedback. And I wanted to know what people were thinking. It was a way for everyone to touch gloves so that everybody on the leadership team knew what everyone else was doing and that no one was running into each other or doing things that would somehow set us up for internal conflict. Also, it was a way to work together to avoid trouble. As a speaker, I would set the agenda, and I'd try to keep it to the main two or three things that we needed to discuss. I tried to build consensus, making sure everybody felt comfortable as we decided on a course of action. There were very rare instances when I had to cut off discussion and say, "No, sorry, but we're doing it this way." That must have happened fewer than 5 times in the 5 years I was speaker. Consensus is always the much better way to go. Sharing information honestly and openly was the best way to make sure nobody got blindsided. But the responsibility of the leadership, especially the speaker, isn't just to deal with other leaders. You have a responsibility to every single member of your conference. They were the ones who put you in the speaker's chair in the first place, and you have to forgive the ones who didn't vote for you. You owe your time and attention to everyone, from the most senior committee chairman down to the newest freshman. Arguably, the more time a good leader spends with freshman members, the better. The early years can set the tone for someone's entire congressional career. They get themselves elected, sure. But somewhere along the line, they've got to learn how to become members of Congress, especially when there's a big new class like there was in 1994 or 2010. Most of the Tea Party class of 2010 were just good, solid Republicans. It's just that a lot of them hadn't served in office before. The leadership offices tried to provide as much help as we could to help new members find the right staff, get on the right committees, and generally find their way around. Some of them figured it out, and some, well, You can't save all of them. Cultivating these individual members can eventually, if enough of them get on board, lead to the creation of a cohesive team out of 200 and some scrappy, lazy, smart, dumb, kind, nasty, opinionated, boring people all thrown together in Washington to represent millions of their fellow Americans. I used to see being leader as being more than whatever title you held, minority leader, even speaker. You're not just a figurehead. You're a principal. You're a dean of students. You're somewhere between a father and an older brother figure. There are all kinds of roles you need to play in order to keep your team together. There were times when I had to bring certain members into my office, younger ones usually, and let them know I'd got wind of them doing something they shouldn't. Come on, boys, I'd have to tell them. You're just cruising for a bruising. Keeping everyone under control not only protects the members themselves, but it protects the institution. A member of Congress behaving badly makes the whole House look bad and can derail whatever legislative priorities you're trying to get done to actually do something for the people who elected you. Nobody has time for bullshit like that. Speaking of bullshit, I learned early on that there's a high tolerance for that on Capitol Hill, particularly in meetings. Some days it just seemed like you were slow motion drowning in a never-ending stream of meetings. And there are a lot of people who show up for a lot of meetings where they have lots of conversations and then nothing happens. Nobody wants to step up and make a plan. I figured out pretty quickly in the absence of any other plan, your plan becomes the plan. After that, I made sure to never walk into a meeting without a plan. If you're going to spend all this time talking about some problem or other, we better be prepared to pick, or at least suggest, an option to fix it. Otherwise, what's the point? And so there were plenty of times when my plan became the plan because there weren't any other ones. This comes in handy when you're dealing in negotiations at the highest levels. Something I kept having to remember over the years as I figured out how things really worked in the smoke-filled rooms of Washington and beyond.